Us on the Seahawks Collective presented by Hog Media. We're excited because the Seahawks have 13 wins. The last two times the Seahawks had 13 wins, they went to this game called the Super Bowl. But the first task ahead, win the division, and you know, while you're at it, win the conference. Why not? We'll get into all of it with these guys who cover the Seahawks the closest this season. Michael Shandugar covering the Hawks for The Athletic, Rob Staton from the Seahawks draft blog, and Brian Emhauser, the Hawk blogger. We've got a packed show ahead going through the Seahawks' last regular season game. So make sure you ask these guys any questions you have for them in the chat. That's why we're doing this show, is for the 12s. But before we kick off with all the things about the game, I do want to point out something that I think really showed the unity from top down to this team. John Schneider pulling up to the game in a Derek Hall jersey. You got a close look at it. I think it was his actual game day jersey. At first glance, I was like, you know, maybe it's a jersey, maybe it's from the pro shop. No, this is the real thing. So I'd love to know from you, Brian, just when you see John pulling up in that jersey, what did you think about that?
You know, AB, I thought that it was just John doing what I think has become customary to like the culture I think he's been trying to create since he's taken over as the lead guy. And I think everyone in that building felt like it was very obvious that Derek Hall was not maliciously trying to hurt anybody, and that I think they had a lot of confidence that that suspension was going to be overturned. And when it wasn't, you know, I thought it was exactly the kind of leadership that you want to see from the top of the football org. And I think it's something that probably will be meaningful to Derek Hall and to other players that probably were standing behind him.
Rob, were you surprised to see John pull up in the jersey?
No, it did look like a snug fit, though, I have to say.
I was going to leave that for you, Rob.
No, it's great.
They're supposed to be tight. You don't want them to get pulled.
You should see how many of the guys that need help getting their jerseys on in the locker room all the time. It's true. They are tight.
There was that one angle of that kind of emerged about a day after the Rams game, which made it look like he did trip up. And I don't really understand why he ended up in a suspension after seeing that. Now, I think the guy, is it Ramon Foster who did it? I interviewed him once. He seemed really nice. So, that was a misjudgment. But I don't understand why that wasn't overturned. And I do find this kind of, this NFL's tendency to go back after the event and throw around 1,000 fines after games and find ways to suspend players a bit strange. So disappointing, but glad that they won without him.
There's certainly a lot of that. And Mike, when you looked at that moment, I know it can be kind of funny with the jersey, but it does resemble unity, like we've talked about. Is there maybe another moment throughout this season, or maybe something that hasn't been reported on that you just noticed that really does also show that same sentiment?
Maybe not something along the same lines, though. I do remember when back in the day, seeing John in the jersey. First off, I saw Justin Britt post it. That's how I actually ever saw it. So I was very confused, because if you look at it from Justin posting it, you can't see the five. So I was like, wait, is he wearing Justin Britt's jersey because Justin Britt is signing? I was like very confused. I went to his account because also he has like hashtag the comeback, hashtag call me in the caption. So I was like, wait, what's going on? Because no, Justin's number was 68. So I was then very glad to know that it was just a D Hall tribute, which reminded me of when Marshawn did the same thing when Cam was holding out. He wore his jersey to practice. Would have been 2015. But I think I may have reported this or not, but it's been cool to hear that teammates have lifted up each other. Feels like they've randomly had a lot of dads die this year. I think at least three. Drew Locke's father, and he wears like hats that say his father's name. Ernest, his father. Maybe one more. I don't want to guess which player, but there's at least one more. So, but you hear the it's cool. They've been lifting each other up in that, either even if it's the guys who are bonding through that, or just like teammates know, hey, you're dealing with that. That's pretty huge, because like in football, you're supposed to be able to put whatever's going on like to the side. You know, it's like, I got this going on at home, or this going back at college, or whatever. I'm going to a divorce, whatever. You just got to check that at the door. All right, we got special teams meeting at 8. It's like, well, yeah, that sounds cool, but that's hard, right? Like if I just go into this thing, I don't really care that we have special teams meeting at 9. I don't care if we got DB meeting. I don't care if we're going over through red zone. I just lost someone, got into an argument with my significant other. Kids are sick, whatever. So that's been cool to hear the small instances that guys are aware of that and then picked each other up. The one that stands out to me is like how Ernest would talk about how big someone like Spoon was when his dad died. Ernest's dad died. And just like guys know, like, hey, man, you're going through something. Or even like last year when Ernest got here and he was going through it, just mentally we're getting traded everything. He was like, Spoon was one of the guys that was just like, he never let me have a bad day, which is cool. Because as you guys know, Ernest wears his heart on his sleeve. So you can easily tell when he's having a bad day. And so recognizing that and being like, I'm going to go pick up my guy. That's really cool. Not the same as a suspension thing, but like along the same lines of like, you know, the team being really close.
That's awesome. And it 100% leads into what happens on the field and how hard they fight for each other. And this defense specifically, just dominant, if you, for lack of truly a better word, they held the Panthers to just 40 passing yards, had multiple takeaways. The Seahawks now have 4 players with at least 6 sacks on the season. And just for you, Rob, what stood out to you when you look at how they were able to give Carolina such a problem?
Well, the defense just smothered them, really. It wasn't with the amazing pass rush just making Bryce Young's life a misery. And there wasn't anything sort of that obvious to sort of point to. It was just like a complete unit performing at a very high standard, which is what it's been all season. And they needed it as well, because I was a bit confused by the game plan and offense. It was almost as if they decided, okay, this is what we're expecting from the Panthers. They didn't get what they're expecting, and it took them too long to pivot to that. For me, it was the weather and the situation was saying, just play defense and run the ball. Like, that's what it should have been. Charbonnet was running very well. They stuck with the pass a little bit too long for my liking, and Sam Darnold again was jittery. But the defense kept them in it, and they kept them in it long enough for them to find at least a couple of answers. So what was a very frustrating game for 3/4 of the game ended up being a 17-point win. And afterwards, you kind of look at the scoreline and you think, I don't know what I was worried about. But while watching the game, it was actually quite frustrating for large stretches. But that there's been a few games like that this season. And, you know, it's another good win. And they have now officially, in my opinion at least, avoided any kind of I can't believe they lost that game type moment against a team they had no business losing to. When they lost to the Buccaneers, they were red hot. They lost to a good Rams team and they lost to a good Niners team. So job done in that regard.
Well, Sunday certainly wasn't a game that you just kick back and relax until the very end. So yes, there was reason to be stressed, but Brian, I'm sure you've watched a lot of film and gone through this game. When you look back on the tape, is there maybe a defensive player who just really stood out to you that you might've missed the first time?
Well, that's a good question, AB. You know, I'll get to that in 1 second. One of the things that was kind of going through my head when Rob was talking about, you know, they've gotten to this point without losing a game they shouldn't lose, was like going back to the 2013 team, the last team that won, the only team that's won a Super Bowl for the Seahawks. And I think a lot of people forget how much the last month of that season was an absolute struggle for the offense. They lost 17-19 to a 49ers team. They only had 264 yards of offense that game. Then they scored 23 points the next week. Then they lost to the Cardinals. Russell Wilson threw a bunch of picks. They only had 192 yards of offense. And there was a lot of concern about the offense kind of heading in. And to think that that team, as good as they were, lost 2 of their last 4 games heading into the playoffs, I think it's just kind of a reminder how hard it is to be as consistently good and winning as the Seahawks have been. And I don't think that's nothing, I guess. Like, people, you look at the Rams last night against the Falcons, you look at the Bucs against pretty much anybody the last like 6 weeks. It's not hard to lose in the NFL. It's really hard to win. And the Seahawks have done that time and time and time again without everything working. And so getting to your question, I mean, defensively, I think the guy that for me, it was really great to see him make a play was Julian Love. This is a guy that obviously was just getting back after being injured. And, you know, has been playing full snaps now. And, you know, that was a classic Julian Love interception. It was a play where I've seen him bait Seahawks quarterbacks in practice multiple times, not with that exact same play, but he is just a super savvy, smart player, and he is sneaky athletic. I think people don't really expect it of him, but I'll never forget when Devin Witherspoon had his interception return for touchdown in New York a few years ago during his rookie year. Julian Love came flying out of nowhere to catch up with Spoon on that. And I was like, whoa, like, who is that? And I just think that's a guy that is now just, I think, getting back to his full fighting form. And it couldn't come at a better time.
Yeah, I mean, we rarely saw him in the beginning of the season. And it's like an added bonus because of the ready squad and what they've been able to do. You're almost like, sweet, we get this Julian Love bonus. Really halfway through the season. But another guy who had a takeaway, DeMarcus Lawrence, Mike McDonald saying that D-Law, it's a play just waiting to happen. It's a player who's really truly made a new home here in Seattle and has gotten some significant shout outs throughout the season. So Mike, when you think about the impact that he has had, why do you think it's been working so well in Seattle for him?
Yeah, I think that one of their many sayings that they have with ball finds energy, and D-Law is probably, you know, the epitome of that, or that personified, whatever vocab word I should use there. I mean, you look at the play, he reads it wrong. I'm pretty sure he thinks that they're passing it, so he just flies upfield, which is fine, because then he just like, you know what, I'll just go get the ball to make up for it. It was almost the same thing against the Vikings when he had the forced fumble on the like a screen pass or something. He completely just plays that wrong. I don't even know what he was looking at. His explanation didn't even make sense after the game. And then, well, you know, he just goes and hustles and makes a play. I think I led my story with that on The Athletic after the game, because it was not only cool to hear people talk about D-Law, but then hear the younger players talk about how that inspires them, or not inspires, but just sets the tone. I think with Tai Okada and Nicky Mwore were just like, when those guys are running to the ball like that, I mean, what else are we going to do as young guys? We got to run to the ball. We got to hit like that. We got to play like that, because that's the standard. And if a D-Law can do that in year 11 or something, whatever this is, like, then if you're in year two, year three, year one, like Nick is, or if you're just a young buck, you got to do that too. And that's why you sign veterans. They need to produce as well. I think that's always first and foremost. You don't pay a guy like $10 million to be an extra coach. But on top of producing, you want them to have an impact on the younger players. And I think that was really cool. It's just an example of like, yeah, ball, you know, guy finding the ball or ball finding energy, excuse me. And then, yeah, it just really set the tone for what was a crazy dominant defensive performance. That was so crazy considering how like well Bryce had been playing. Going into that game, I finished the tape a few hours ago. I texted my homie who's from Charlotte. I was like, you guys should draft a QB. This is bad. They look really, really bad. And they made him look that way. Bryce has never looked like that. I watched a lot of Bryce games. When I have homies who are fans of a team, I like watch the game, you know, and text them. So I'm like,
yeah,
okay.
You're a real one, Mike.
Yeah, it leads me, though, to watch some really bad teams. Like, I've watched a lot of the Jets in the last, like, 3 years. They're a train wreck, so it's just fun now. But anyway, so, yeah, I was like, yeah, Bryce is playing really well. We'll see how it goes. And then he just threw for 54 yards. I was like, how do you throw for 54 yards on 24 attempts? And I watched the tape, and I was like, oh, he's scared to throw the ball. He was just dropping back, check down, dropping back, check down, dropping back, check down. And the reason that he didn't give up any yards is because I think this was the best tackling game they had all year.
It was so
like,
good.
Rico Dowdle and Chuba Hubbard are probably getting chewed out by the running backs coach like right now, because they broke no tackles like at all. They were just catching the ball, getting dropped, which is great for the Seahawks and bad for the Panthers. But that's why, despite completing 14 passes, he only threw for 54 yards, because he would, you know, Rico Dowdle broke like -3 passes or tackles on Sunday. It was just incredible and great tackling, particularly by Ty Spoon and Chenna had an open field tackle too. Just great. Perfect stuff.
Rob, Mike talked about just the ripple down effects that D-Law has had on the other defenders, but how have you seen his just relentless effort affect the other players?
Well, I think he's just had a fantastic season, hasn't he? He's not somebody who's going to, I don't think he's ever been like a 15 sack guy, has he? He's always kind of been up towards double figures. And he's going to be sort of there or thereabouts again, just a bit short of that. But he's just his intensity, his physicality off the edge. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about his addition is it's kind of shed a bit of light as to what Mike Macdonald will actually be looking for in the future with defensive ends, because I think he's very much a DeMarcus Lawrence physique, playing style, than maybe a Boye Mafe. I think we're probably going to discover that in the next 3 or 4 months, that they may well go and add another player who has more of that sort of physicality and relentlessness off the edge.
All right, Rob, we know you want to talk about it. You wrote about it earlier this week. Here you go. Here's your
first. I mean, everyone will be getting excited about it. I think there's probably a decent chance they will go after Max Crosby, but we'll see. I mean, that's the kind of player, isn't it? And if you could have him with DeMarcus Lawrence and Nwosu and Hall, I know that's feels like a very Mike Macdonald group. I just think there's a few people like that. Lawrence, Jaron Reed, Ernest Jones. You know, that I think if you are going to be a really top defense, you need some guys who've just got that look in their eye. You know, they've just got that look, as you know, the when they get out on the field, they're not really nice people when you're playing them. Like, they might be off the field, but like they're not nice on the field. And when I look at DeMarcus Lawrence and Jaron Reed and Byron Murphy and Ernest Jones, they've got that look in their eye. So I think you need that. 2013, they definitely had a bit of that. So yeah, I think DeMarcus Lawrence has done as much as anybody to kickstart that. And I've not run through the entire list of free agent signings in 2025 to put a ranking or anything together, but I'd be surprised if there have been as many that have had the impact that DeMarcus Lawrence has had this year.
Nice guys off the field, not so nice guys on the field. And just from you, Brian and Mike, because we're on it, just your quick thoughts on if you think that will happen, if we'll see Crosby come to Seattle.
I think it's a likely thing the Seahawks will try. I think they've already tried it multiple times. I got to tell you, AB, I'm like, my head is all the way into the 49ers game. Like, I can't even think about offseason stuff right now. I'm reading comments in chat from 49ers fans bragging about Brock Purdy's record against the Seahawks. Like, that matters at all. If you want to play that game, like, let's talk about Brock Purdy's record against Mike Macdonald. We'll get into that in a little bit. But yes, I think Max Crosby makes sense, you know, but he's not going to help on Sunday or Saturday, I should say.
So, Rob, just stay focused. Just stay focused on the task ahead.
No.
It's because the draft sucks, man. It doesn't mean you have to, like, come up with Crosby stuff.
That's exactly why I have to do it.
I will say that, well, one, I don't think they'll end up with Max, just because I think John will be a little weary again of bringing in someone and already making them the highest paid player. He's already talked about making that mistake with Percy and hasn't made it since. So I don't think you would have to. Max, well, no matter if you like redid his deal, it'd be hard to get that cap hit down to where he's not your highest paid player, let alone just highest paid defensive player. But on D-Law, real quick before we move on, I do think, Rob, someone asked us about this on the podcast about whether D-Law was the best free agent signing in the NFL. And probably not, because quarterbacks have so much value. It would be hard for it to just like not be Sam, or even like Daniel Jones was like super valuable, you know. But I do think, and you can argue like Devontae was really good, you know, helped his quarterback lead the league in touchdown passes. I think Diggs is going to help his quarterback be MVP. But I think D-Law is the best defensive free agent signing of the offseason. I actually feel very good about that. I'm not even sure, just looking at a list, I'm not even sure it's particularly close. Like, John, I think, got the best defensive free agent signing of 2025, which is huge.
I appreciate no one wants to talk about Max Crosby. I get it. If they did trade for him, his contract is very easy to acquire. He would be, I think, the second or third highest paid player in Seattle in terms of cap hit, if they acquired him. And that's without accounting for the inevitable contract extensions that are coming for JSN and Devin Witherspoon and potentially Charles Cross as well, which could push him further down the list. And I will say, I think if there's one player, like Percy Harvin and Max Crosby are very different people. And I think if there's one player you can trust, you know, if there's one thing about Max Crosby, he is 100% football, and you know what you're getting there. I mean, the guy's pissed off because he's not playing two meaningless games for the worst team in the NFL. I think that's, if there's one player you'd feel pretty good about bringing in and people accepting he's getting paid, it's probably that guy.
And he splashes his jump shots, man. That was a pretty impressive shooting display he's putting on in his crib. So,
and the dog enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
Well, if I was a standout defender in the NFL. I know which defense I would want to go play for. So we'll see it. But Rob, you mentioned it earlier, just the Seahawks offense. And I'm sure there's other parts of this offense that we'll want to discuss on how it can be better for Saturday's winner take all game. But I do want to give some airtime to Zach Charbonnet, over 100 yards running, rushing, two touchdowns, his 11th of the season. That puts him in category with Marshawn Lynch in 2014, having double digit touchdown numbers. And Brian, describe what Zach Charbonnet has meant for the in that game on Sunday, but also what he's probably too quiet for the Seahawks team in the season as a whole.
Yeah, I love that you bring him up, AB. I think most people in the NFL that are NFL fans know him as the Vulture, because a lot of Ken Walker owners in fantasy football have been very frustrated by Zach Charbonnet's role near the goal line. But as a Seahawks follower and supporter, I mean, I think he's done his job really well. And I think you kind of got to go back to the beginning of the season, where the first time they played the 49ers, Zach Charbonnet had more success than Ken Walker. And the question was like, the team, there was a lot of buzz going into the season that the team was kind of leaning towards Zach Charbonnet being their starter. And that game was like, oh man, this really might happen. And then Ken Walker against Pittsburgh went off, and it's taken a while, but we've finally been able to see both players produce in the same game. And, you know, this was not necessarily the best example of that, but one of the things I've seen from Zach Charbonnet is not just the goal line, not just the touchdowns, but his ability to evade, not just, you know, run through tackles, I feel like has been the best we've seen from him the last few games he's played. He's making people miss in small spaces. Mike McDonald talked about black zone runs, and then that's generally like close to the goal line, but I think it's also some of the short yardage runs where he's making people miss right near the line of scrimmage with multiple people around him. And he's also been explosive, which is something that I think a lot of people don't associate with Zach Charbonnet. They just think he's a bruiser. But, you know, even in his first season, there were times where he actually had a higher explosive rush rate than Ken Walker. It's just different. You know, he doesn't have necessarily the top end. He's going to go the distance, but he is a guy that can pick up a 15, 20 yard run. And he did that multiple times in this game. So I think it's only good news that the Seahawks finally are getting a little bit of the duo that they envisioned between those two players. And it couldn't come at a better time, because you are going to need the run game to be effective. And just look at the Rams' run defense lately. That's given up almost 200 yards rushing a game the last two games. There's some teams that have flaws. The 49ers do not defend the run very well. They don't defend anything really well, to be honest. But being able to run the football keeps it out of Sam Darnold's hands, lowers pass attempts, and increases the chances that you're going to be able to limit possessions, which makes it all the harder for offenses to be able to score against the best defense in football. So I think it was a really, really nice game for Zach Charbonnet, and a pretty important one as well.
Well, Rob, earlier this week, you said if the Seahawks could just run the ball, they could win the Super Bowl. Does that Carolina game reflect that enough for you?
No, I mean, it is one game. And sadly, it kind of followed the pattern of one of the running backs having a really good game and the other not having a good game. And you know, maybe next week it'll be Ken Walker that plays really well and Zach Charbonnet won't. It seems to have been that kind of a season. But I mean, I don't think they fixed anything. I actually was a little bit surprised. This was part of the frustration for me of the game, was if it wasn't for the final five carries on that final drive, scoring drive that started on the 25-yard line, that Ken Walker would have actually had more carries than Zach Charbonnet in that game, when everyone could see that Zach Charbonnet was, quote-unquote, the hot hand. Like, it just felt like, why? It was a day just to hand the ball to him and just say, that's what we're going to do. And they resisted doing it even then. And there's a couple of things that worry me going into not only this game but the playoffs, and that is the slow starts in offense, the turnovers, and this apparent need for the defense to just stick in it long enough so the offense can work it out. I've seen Seahawks playoff games where they dig themselves into a big hole and then they needed like Russell Wilson to try and bail them out in the second half, just running around and making backyard plays. I don't want to do that again. I don't want to have to try and repeat the Rams game from the week before last. I want the offense to start better. I want them to get a feel for the game quickly, and I want them to stop turning the ball over at a rate that is higher than everybody except the Minnesota Vikings, with JJ McCarthy and Max Brosma at quarterback. So if they could just do that, then they've got a really good chance of winning the Super Bowl. And look, they might have anyway, because they've got to 13-3, maybe 14-3, hopefully, fingers crossed, touch wood, with all of this stuff. So maybe it just doesn't matter. And it's just something, one of these things we'll talk about until the hoisting a trophy.
Hey, it doesn't matter how they get it done. We just really, really want them to get it done. And Rob, you mentioned the slow start. And Mike, I know that you wrote about that, how the defense has a really good habit of just staying steady while the offense isn't rolling. What do you think a reason could be maybe for these slow starts?
So I don't think Mike McDonald's correct. It's really not one thing. But if I had to try to find a thing, it seems there's a strong correlation between like when you get an explosive play or on a drive and if you score points on that. There's like a number. I remember my colleague Jordan Rodriguez did like this deep dive on it a few years ago. Basically, if you get at least one explosive, your odds of scoring on that drive go like way up, especially. And she did that deep dive before the new kickoff rule. So now if you get it on a 35 and you get an explosive, all these kickers are kicking with a new ball and they all have just like juice in their legs. You get across midfield, you basically, and everyone's going for it on fourth now. You know, it's just so much easier to score. The Seahawks offense is not very explosive in these first halves, which is why they're not scoring any points in these first halves. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's mostly like not a lot of explosive runs, which is why, I mean, you see the Panthers game, they end up getting some. And then, you know, you go score. Zach provided them. You look at the Rams game is a good example of what happens when you get those explosives. You know, look at the drives where they had points. You get Ken actually just ran in from 55 yards. They got the Ken screen pass for 46 yards on the first drive. What do you know? They score points. So explosives equal points. How do you get those? Different teams go about it a different way. Some teams are really good on the run. Some teams play action. Here, drop back like the Bengals. The Seahawks are funky because for a while there, it was like, if we throw the ball to Jax, it's an explosive.
Sorry, if you throw the ball to who? JSN? Did you say JSN? Sorry. I'm just going to keep this on because, known fact, JSN is undefeated in a cowboy hat. So, Mike, while you talk about JSN, I'm just going to keep this on just for good luck.
I'll come back to my explosive point, but now I have to share with you a convo I had with Brian in Carolina when I saw on Instagram coming into the stadium that Jax was wearing a cowboy hat. I said, Brian, it is your job to keep track of Jax's stats when he wears a cowboy hat. And so I don't actually, I was gonna put you on the spot. You don't, oh man.
I didn't know. I mean, I know it now. I know they're undefeated, but I didn't know it then. And I'm not gonna hide behind it. Yeah. I will offer you something, Mike. While you were talking, you talk about the slow starts. The Seahawks averaged 19 points per first half through the first 10 weeks of the season. Since week 12 after the Rams game, they've averaged 8.5 points. So this wasn't always a problem, but they are scoring less than half what they used to. And, so it's an issue.
Yeah, no, they're genuinely not a good first half offense when I'd looked at the numbers, it was since the Rams game, like including that one, cause they only scored, I think 9 first half points in that one as well. So, makes the probably doesn't change the overall number you just gave, but yeah, the sentiment is the same. They're not very good in the first halves of games. How do you fix that? You need to get explosives. Where do you get them from? For some reason, they can't get them throwing the ball to Shaheed, which is really annoying. And it's not something they'll probably be able to fix this week because he's in the concussion protocol. But like Jax was the key there for a little bit because safeties were just playing him very poorly and you could just bomb it over them. There's not as much of that. Teams got more discipline, which was to be expected, right? Like the film's out, right? You don't want to be the team to give that up. Not getting them to Shaheed was a surprising thing. I thought that would click after, you know, a few weeks. It's not been as consistent as you'd like. The run game, I'm with Rob, at least in the sentiment of that. Like, I don't like the splitting thing. Like if one guy's got it, let them roll. You know, I crunched some numbers after talking about McDonough on Monday, and go look at the games where a guy has 100. It's not many. It's only 3. But like, go look at what the other guy did in that game. It's like the most inefficient set of carries you'll find. Like in that Steelers game, Zach had like 15 carries for like 10 yards or something like that. I think the final drive juiced that a little bit, but still, it was very clear that Ken had it that day. You know, very just like it was in the Panthers game. And even look at the Rams game, Ken had like 11 for 100. And then Zach had like some inefficient set of numbers. So it really does feel like, especially now that fantasy season's over, because I was one of those people Brian mentioned complaining about Ken getting vultured. Now that it's over, no one's going to complain now. If Ken's hot, it's Ken's day. If Zach's hot, it's Zach's day. I think the going back and forth is useless and doesn't help either running back. But once they get some more explosives, I think early in games to guys not named Jax, because teams are doing a good job on him right now, that's where I think they'll come out hot. And I think the Rams game is a perfect example. They got an explosive to someone not named Jax, and they scored on the opening drive. Like, the formula is there to me.
Can I just say real quick, though, counter to that, are we sure that there would be two running backs to ride one of them if they hadn't been doing this all season? Like, keep in mind, going into the year, there were question marks about whether Ken Walker was going to be able to be available for a full season. I think they came in with a plan to make sure to load balance and that they didn't want to just have one bell cow. Now, we can debate how they've executed that. I don't think we can debate the fact is Ken Walker's as available as he's ever been, and Zach Charbonnet's there as well. Both of them are gaining steam at this point in the year, and so maybe there's something to the way that they handled the reps.
You can go in with a plan to split. I think that's fine. But when it's clear one guy is rolling, I see no reason to maintain that plan, which is, I think, what they've done in a few of these games. And now sometimes the splits can get a little funky because Zach plays on third downs because he's a much better pass protector. So if you get in a 2-minute drill as well, Zach can have like a higher snap count, stuff like that. But the Panthers game, I think, is the best example, like Rob was saying. Like, why was at some point you just had to realize it's Zach's day. Right? And that happens. And sometimes not even Zach or Ken's fault. You look at some of the blocking in that game. It was just like, do you guys even like Ken? Like, this guy's just not blocking Derrick Brown for some reason. And then Ken's just cooked for a 2-yard loss or whatever. And sometimes that happens. It quite literally happened to Zach in the Steelers game. It was like, why won't you guys block Cameron Hayward when Zach gets the ball? But you'll block him when Ken gets the ball. Made no sense. But that, I think that's what they need to do going in. Like, let's use both guys. They're both healthy. Of course, every team uses two guys, but they've had a couple games now where it's like clearly one guy, this scheme, this front, this type of run is hitting. We got to spam that today, as opposed to like maintaining the rotation. For what it's worth, I think they should do that at corner as well. Like, if it's clear Reek has it or Job has it or whatever, ditch the rotation. Both of them can handle the snaps. I think they've been doing that. It hasn't mattered really, but I could see that mattering in the playoffs where it's like Reek's hot. You take him off the field, you bring Job in, not as hot, you know. So I'm really just kind of against that whole ignoring the hot, quote unquote hot hand thing, no matter what position it is, for the most part.
Well, I'm going to keep this hat on for my other receiver question, I guess receiver tight end, but he was the second leading receiver in the game after JSN. So we'll keep this on just for some good vibes from the wide receiver, AJ Barner. Mike McDonald calling him a spark plug for this team. You've seen his ability to block, but catch meaningful touchdowns, to execute the barnyard, but also really do well on the hard count. He's gotten teams to jump offside 4 times this season. Rob, for you, when you think back to the beginning of the season, I feel so silly in this hat right now. I can't even tell you.
It's working. It's working.
I love it. Like, when you think back to the beginning of the season, Rob, did you expect A.J. Barner to become such a leader for this team and really a guy that's brought up the vibe?
Before I answer, I have also got a JSN. I have a JSN hoodie on today.
This is the one show where Brian and Mike did not get the memo. So here we are, Rob.
There we are. I didn't expect A.J. Barner to be quite this impactful, because when you draft a tight end in round 2, and I was a huge Elijah Arroyo fan, I did think that as the season went on, he would develop and emerge into a really dynamic threat, you know, and get a lot of the yards and a lot of the targets that were going to go in the passing game to the tight end. He's obviously injured, so it's never really had a chance. This will go down, chalk it down to experience, his rookie season, I suppose, and come back next year and see what he can do. But he was always going to have a role, wasn't he? Because he had a really good rookie season, and I think he impressed everybody with the way. My take on him last year was that he came in as a blocking tight end. His blocking wasn't very good, but his receiving was really good. And that was kind of the other way around of what everyone's expecting. And then this year, he's been a very balanced, quality tight end. He is not he's not a mismatch weapon, is he? He's not Kittle. He's not Brock Bowers. he's not going to be that kind of player that that teams have a nightmare trying to game plan for every single time they come up against the Seahawks. But he's somebody who, for me, he needs to have a role. Like, you need to have plays where he's the sort of the target and the feature of that play call. And on Sunday, it did feel a little bit like, for the first time, fans were going, get the ball to Barner. Like, why isn't Barner more involved? And then he got the touchdown. And you think, okay, that's where he's at now. You know, where fans want to see him more involved in the passing game. And I agree with him. And if you look, there's going to have to be some games, I think, in the playoffs where just accept it. Just accept, run the ball. Whoever's getting the carries, run the ball. And then some play action and use your tight end and get him the football, especially in the red zone, I think tremendous. And he's become an asset. And the Seahawks needed to do this. They went a long time where they weren't finding, you know, quality starters in day three of the draft. And he's a good example of someone who they've really hit on here, who is providing an immense amount of value as a day three pick.
I think it's fair to say you won't see a Seahawks game without some explosive plays, and whether that's on the ground or in the air, it's going to happen one way or another. And just, Brian, for you on AJ Barner, what has impressed you so much with his impact this season?
You know, I think the stuff on the field's a lot easier to see than the stuff off. One of the questions I've got, and still a question, is who's going to be the person that really grabs that offense when it needs someone to speak up and kind of shake them out of the doldrums or a rut or whatever's going on? Defensively, I can point at Leonard Williams, Ernest Jones, Kobe Bryant, Julian Love, like DeMarcus Lawrence, Jaren Reed, like the list goes on and on. Uchenna Nwosu, like there's a lot of guys that will stand up and say, hey, this isn't to our standard. Devin Witherspoon, I didn't even say him. Like, I mean, it just goes on and on. Offensively, it's a lot of quiet dudes. It's a lot of humble, hardworking. Doesn't mean that they're not super talented. Even JSN is by nature soft-spoken, quiet, right? We love him for it, right?
We'll wear a cowboy hat to a game, but is soft-spoken and quiet.
Exactly, AB. And I think AJ Barner's the one right now. Like, he's the one guy. His hard count is not just, you know, because he's got a loud voice for that moment. I think he's got a loud voice that he's starting to learn how to use as a leader. And it's only his second year, and there's guys in there that are more veteran than he is. But you see the team actually putting him in position to step forward in that way as well. More time at the podium, after games, between games, and I think you see him kind of feeling more comfortable, and reminds me a little bit, like very different circumstances, but a little bit of Cam Chancellor. His first season, Cam's a very quiet dude, but he's just innately a leader, and Pete Carroll kind of prodded him going into his second year to be more vocal, even though he was not the oldest, even though he was not like the loudest necessarily. And I think Cam was a really huge leader without necessarily being about what he said. I think AJ is going to be more about what he says, but I think he's also that young, potential, precocious leader that the offense needs. I believe it. And there was a comment after the first Rams game where they lost that stuck with me, which was Cooper Kupp in the post-game presser talking about that there is like, no one really bringing the energy on the sideline. And he was critical of himself for not doing that. And that was kind of a red flag to me. And that's when I started thinking, like, who is the person that's going to bring it? Because there's not a lot of voices. I think AJ, he's going to be increasingly important to be that voice.
I think that comes with too, when you think back to last season, it wasn't, you know, just AJ, it was Pharaoh Brown and Noah Fant. And those are older guys in the room, right? Which as a younger player, that's just a subconscious tendency maybe to not be as vocal, but you've certainly seen it from him this season. We've got some key injury updates to get to, and really more importantly, probably break down how the Seahawks can claim the one seed with a win in Levi Stadium. But first, let's take a look at our sponsor for the season, the Sleeper app. So check out this quick video.
Sleeper is the number one fantasy sports app. It pays to know sports. Pick more or less on top players. Your first pick is on us, so start winning now. Play in Texas, Georgia, Minnesota, and 27 more states. Pick anytime across all sports, pregame or live. Over 10 million players are already on Sleeper. Make your picks count. Score up to 1,000 times your cash. Join today. Get up to $100 credit using code HMA. Call your shot on Sleeper. Download now.
Sleeper app is not JSN, so they don't get the cowboy hat. But check it out because it's great to keep up with all that's going on. The news alerts, stats, live scores. You win real money in real-time chats with others. So check out the number one sports app today and try it out for yourself. Use promo code HMA and you'll get up to a $100 match on your first deposit. Terms and conditions apply. See Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational in over 25 states. So check out the Sleeper app today. And really, what we've seen all season is the Seahawks just bring this no-flinch attitude onto the field. And really, too, how they have handled the injuries that have happened. And they found a way to stay ready with the ready squad. However, we did see a player who you guys have mentioned earlier on the show go down, Rashid Shaheed, dealing with a concussion. Mike McDonald said they don't really know. It's going to be a few days until they can really give us a final answer. What should we know about, you know, where this might go, Mike?
Yeah, I think it sucks because safety first, but I don't believe we've seen a guy go in the concussion protocol for this team and then play the next week. Usually they've at least had to wait a week, I believe. No, Job did. Reek practiced and then still didn't play. I think that was against the Jags that he missed. Maybe there's one I'm forgetting, but I'm operating under the impression that they won't have Rashid. Cody White just got put on IR. Cody also put on Instagram that his season's over. Which sucks. Like, looks like he pulled his groin or something on that first punt, which is unfortunate. And I think that's actually quietly pretty big. You know, AJ Barner, who we're just talking about, becomes very important in that regard. If they don't have Shaheed and they already won't have Cody, you know, you look at the tape and the Panthers. Now, the part of this is because the Seahawks probably just weren't prepared to lose both guys, but the Panthers were not moved by like Derek Young go routes and, you know, Cooper Kupp going vertical. That was not pulling safeties. It helps the Seahawks have short fields, so it didn't matter. But yeah, that they need other people who strike fear in the defense's heart, you know, and make them, you know, threaten them, make them move. So I don't think they'll have Rashid. I hope they do, but I don't think they will. That's where AJ becomes very important. This what Brian just mentioned about the Cooper Kupp anecdote made me think of, actually, I think it was Albert Breer after the game. Apparently talked to AJ and wrote that AJ got vocal with guys in the locker room after that, or at halftime of the Panthers game. He says, quote, this is told to Breer, pull this up. Yeah, he says, we had to get a little, we being him and Jay Reed, we had to get a little vocal and get a little juice going, mentioned that it was because it was an East Coast game. And then says, quote, I think we came out with better energy in the second half and played complimentary football. So, yeah, like not only is AJ doing the on-field stuff and going to be important if they don't have Shaheed, but is also like, yeah, he's leader guy, which they need. And, yeah, it does take time. It takes time for guys to be leader dude. You know, Ernest mentioned that to me earlier in the year. He was like, man, because Ernest is also just like Cam Chancellor, kind of just naturally leader guy. But, I mean, he was like, Mike, my first year was Aaron Donald was on the team. So as a rookie, I just shut up. And then my second year, after they won the Super Bowl, it signed Bobby Wagner. So you got to shut up again. You just got to do more shutting up. And then by year three, it was like, okay, I'm leader guy now. But that took 3 years, you know, for a guy who's naturally like that. So yeah, that's one injury thing I'm kind of nervous about and how that affects the offense, the Shaheed thing. But if they have AJ, which they should, that's huge. I think he means a lot to this team right now.
Yeah, certainly unfortunate about Shaheed, and also to hear about Cody White, seeing that post come out from him tonight. And I have two more injuries I do want to ask you guys, but thank you to Jet Hawk for complimenting the hat. You know, I actually received it this Christmas, so I'm super excited about my cowboy hat. Maybe I can twin with JSN for the next game. But also, Charles Cross, do you think we'll be seeing him on Saturday, Rob?
No, I don't, because they've obviously elevated the left tackle today, I think it was, wasn't it? So that speaks to the likelihood that he's not going to make it again this week. So it seems like it was Ian Rappaport who reported it was going to be about a month.
2 to 4 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, sounds as if that's going to be accurate. Now, it has to be said, through 2 weeks so far, it's not really made much of a difference. Now, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference in this game either. Like, if Nick Bosa was playing, it might do. But, I mean, the Niners' defense, I say this in jest, but I even think I could have played for the Bears and maybe got a first down on the other night. They were that bad that really the Seahawks, they have an opportunity to score points even with injuries. If they just hold their serve, don't turn the ball over. They should be able to move the football and put points on the board. And with this exceptional defense, the Niners are going to score some points. They're going to move the ball. It's Kyle Shanahan. He's going to have some success against you. But this offense should be able to ask a few questions as well. And Seattle's defense is just on a different level to Chicago's. So I'm confident they can get through these injury issues.
And quickly, just on the last injury, Kobe Bryant, we know Ty Okada has stepped up like you were talking about, Rob. But Brian, for you, what are your expectations to see Kobe Bryant out there?
You know, probably not likely, I would say, with the knee. And I see it a little differently than Rob on whether it matters with Charles Cross. I thought that Josh Jones actually took a pretty meaningful step back against the Panthers. Panthers defense is not very good either, and their pass rush is as bad as the 49ers. And Josh Jones got beat for a sack, and you know, I am a little concerned how that's going to look against a, you know, under talented but well motivated 49ers team. And so we'll see. I agree with the assessment Rob has that it, based on Amari Kite, the undrafted free agent, being elevated from practice squad to the 53. Probably not expecting Cross back, but I think that's a bigger deal. Kobe Bryant not being there, not quite as big. I mean, I think he is one of the guys that had a pick against Purdy in the first game, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm not positive, but he has a way of finding the ball. And, you know, Ty Okada, for as many great plays as he's made, he has not necessarily been as much of a turnover magnet as Kobe has been. But it's a good chance to kind of remember the arc of Ty Okada and remember that first week of the season, Nick Emenwori gets injured first snap, essentially, and they have to go to plan C and put Ty Okada in as a big nickel, which is not the position he practiced at or was really like meant to play. And it was pretty bad. It was really bad. It was so bad that I think after he gave up the Kittle touchdown, he didn't play again the rest of that game. And there's a lot of fans who are like, never put that guy on the field again after that game. Think about where we are now with Ty Okada. And the fact is that he just steps in for Kobe Bryant and has an excellent game against Carolina. And he's pretty much stacked excellent game after excellent game. So it's not quite the big downgrade that it would have been. But I don't expect Kobe back, but that's just a guess.
And his teammates have had exceptional things to say about him throughout the season. So you can definitely tell that they respect him as a pro and that he's doing everything on and off the field right. But I do want to ask Mike, you one of these questions from the chat, and I'll just kind of tease it off with Mike McDonald had said after the game, immediately after the game, he said, I know it wasn't Sam's best game of all time, but he made some big third down throws in the face of pressure. And, you know, here the comment is asking about Kubiak being the problem, Sam being the problem. Just would love to know from you, like, when you think about Mike McDonald really standing up for Darnold in that way and saying, yes, but look at how he came in clutch for us. Do you feel the same way?
No, I do think they have a turnover problem, which is largely a Sam problem. Like not all the turnovers are like, quote unquote, his fault, you know. But then he has, I think for all one of those that aren't, quote unquote, I could probably find one that probably should have been a turnover that wasn't for reasons that were out of Sam's control. For instance, he avoided two. It was funny. Mike McDonald, as much of a process versus results guy he is, he was like, I asked him, how do you think Sam's playing? And he was like, yeah, well, he's playing good, did enough to win. But then he was like, yeah, he's a smidge away from that ball being incomplete instead of a fumble. And he's like, maybe Michael Jackson didn't get his toe down. So we're almost like very close to a no turnover game. And in my head, we're on Zoom, so I didn't want to argue. But in my head, I'm like, dude, J.C. Horn dropped a pick six the first play. And Gray Zabel I think Jalen Sundell upped his PFF coverage grade by knocking the ball away from Derek Brown, I believe, who would have had an interception. So it's like, for every two of those, that's like, well, here's how I can excuse that. There's two more that's like, dude, that's a turnover-worthy place. And it's something I'm a little worried about because, Sam, that is because whether they are his fault or not, it just seems like it's just going to happen now. There's going to be a couple plays here, a couple plays there. And like the Michael Jackson one, for instance. It's just a bad read, bad decision, bad throw. Reminded me of the Rams game. Just bad, bad, bad. The first Rams game. And I actually did some research with my editor on this. You know, I was wondering, like, can they get to a Super Bowl with the quarterback that leads the league in turnover rate, which he currently does, and raw turnovers, but I think rate is more important. And it's happened before. Since 2000, it's happened, I think, 7 times. Most recent is Peyton Manning in 2015. And Sam's playing better than all of the other quarterbacks who led the league in turnover rate, who made the Super Bowl, with the exception of maybe 2001, Kurt Warner. So, I mean, that's good company, right? In the face of bad company, which is what that stat is, there's some good company to be had. So I do think it's possible. And all those defenses that made it with guys who had really high turnover rates, they were all elite. They were like first in scoring or first in EPA per play, second, you know, with the exception of the 07 Giants. So I do think they have a little bit of a Sam problem. His decision-making, he's getting jittery in the pocket. Even that sack that Josh Jones gave up, as Brian just mentioned, like, yeah, you don't want Josh to get beat off the line by the Wanham dude or whatever like that. But also, Sam could easily just have taken off. Like, he went backwards to go get sacked. It was 2nd and 9. Take off, slide, get 3 yards. We got 3rd and 6. We'll make it happen. You know, it's plays like that, even though it wasn't a turnover, I'm like, decision-making, you know, because they're going to play a lot of good teams here. Unless they play the Panthers again or the Bucks, they're going to play some good teams over the next month. The margin for error is this. Sometimes it is a fat guy catching your pick. Sometimes it is a shin getting down. Look at that Rams
heavy set. Game. Heavy set. We like to use the term heavy set.
Or maybe it's a thick pick. I mean, you know, like something like pick. That, like you had in the Rams game. But like, look how close Puka was.
There's a layer of protection, right? There's a layer of protection you need. You're hitting each other. Like, we totally get it. But I do want to make sure that we have some time to talk about this game on Saturday. And I'm sure a lot of Seahawks fans were also wondering that same question in the chat. And so, Mike, thanks for backing up with that stat, because I think it could, you know, allow some comfort when you look at the historic part of those numbers. But Saturday is going to come sooner than we know. And I do think there's something really cool and poetic about this stadium being where the Super Bowl will be hosted in February. But as you mentioned, Mike, it will not be an easy task. Brock Purdy is playing his best football right now. Christian McCaffrey's on a tear. It is notable. We talked about the Seahawks injuries, but George Kittle is questionable, and their left tackle, Trent Williams, are both listed as questionable for Saturday's game. But when you think of this season, about this season as a whole, I think a lot of Seahawks fans will want to know, okay, looking back to Week 1, how is this team better now? What can we hang our hat on? Okay, yeah, but like, what is that for each of you? And I'll start with you, Rob. The one thing that might be different, most different to you about this Seahawks team.
Well, hopefully they've learned the lesson of not putting a game plan together that didn't make any sense. Because in Week 1, that was pretty much, if you remember, there was a lot of trick plays, a lot of screens. It felt as if they threw that game away and never really gave themselves much of a chance. And then there were obviously big mistakes in the second half. And when you actually watch the highlights back, it dawns on you. Perhaps not so much watching it live, but the Seahawks possibly should have won that game. So hopefully they can just play a cleaner game, can make the right decisions and move forward. But the Niners, you've got to give Kyle Shanahan a tremendous amount of respect. And Brock Purdy's clearly, you know, a very good player now and can make things happen. If George Kittle comes back, then he always plays well against Seattle. I mean, there's a guy in the comments who spent the last hour trying to tell us that Tatum Bethune's the next Fred Warner. And I don't know if he's actually watched Tatum Bethune play. Like, I don't know if he's just inserting that because they've got the same position, because the loon bag's been going on about it for the last hour. And I mean, I've seen him play and he doesn't look very good. So, you know, I'm not sure what he's seeing there. The defense of the Niners is terrible. And it's terrible, admittedly, because they have lost 2 absolute superstars. Like, Fred Warner is my guilty pleasure. Like, I don't like the Niners, but I have to respect the brilliance of Fred Warner. He is one of the players I've watched live that I've probably been most impressed with over the last however many years I've been watching this sport. And not having him and Nick Bosa, it's just a tremendous impact. Just go and win this game. Like, it'll just put a dampener on. I know it's they play the NFC South on the road.
Just win the division. Just get the one seed. Come on. It's that easy.
The amount of joy it will bring to me if they beat the 49ers on Saturday. Like,
what's your celebration, Rob? What's your celebration if they win on Saturday night?
Well, the problem is so it's not a good idea to put this game on a Saturday, because I'll be going to bed at about 6 a.m., right?
I am commentating on a game, so I'm doing the call for a soccer game at 12 p.m. on Sunday. So I am going to have about 3 hours sleep, and then I am going to get up and go to work, and then I'm going to talk to myself for an hour and a half on the air. Like, my celebration will be...
Is it just you on the air? It's just you.
In this instance, it will be just me. And my celebration will be muted but aggressive.
All right.
As a good Englishman, good luck. Always good should luck, be.
Brian, what's the one thing for you that you're hanging your hat on when you look at just this season as a whole and maybe how the Seahawks have progressed since week one?
Yeah, I think there's a subtle piece here that I think might end up being the difference in this game between these two teams. And it's that we talked about how the Seahawks were faster starters at the beginning of the year. They also were playing from the front. They were the team that had the fewest snaps in the NFL playing from behind through the first 10 weeks of the season. Well, the last 6 weeks, they've only been ahead 32% of the snaps. And they've had to win games when their offense has started slow, when their defense has not played well, when they had turnovers. They've had to persevere in ways that they didn't the first 10 weeks. And they've been tested in ways that they weren't. The 49ers right now are basically firing on all cylinders on offense. They have played a lot of really bad defenses, and they're feeling really good about how they're playing. I'm not sure that that defense or that offense and that coach in particular is ready to have it be a little harder on Saturday. And if things don't go really well for them on offense, if it isn't easy, that'll be new for them. For the Seahawks, that won't be new. If it's a slow start, if it's a fast start, if the offense plays well, if the defense, they've done it all. Every part of this team has contributed to wins over the season. They've won every possible way. And I think that sets them up in this game.
Yeah, thank you, Seahawks, for that Thursday night thriller. That's another one to check out.
Exactly. I think this puts them in position, AB, to go in there and do what they intended to do to start the year. And last thing I'll just offer there is people talk a lot about Brock Purdy's record, against the Seahawks. The Seahawks under Mike McDonald are very different. And Kyle Shanahan and Brock Purdy and Christian McCaffrey, they've scored 17 points the last two times they played Mike McDonald's defenses. And it took a lot of heroics from Brock Purdy to get 17 points on that crazy pass to Jake Tonjes in the first game. So I think you're talking about a situation where the Seahawks offense is going against one of the worst defenses in football, while the Seahawks offense is starting to get the run game going. And I think there's a very good chance that there's going to be a lot of very upset and potentially very violent 49ers fans, as they tend to be when things don't go their way, which I'm expecting them not to on Saturday.
The people in the chat got Brian going for this show because he definitely was waiting to say that at the end. Mike, what about you? What's your one major difference from the beginning to where we are now, week 18?
I'm going to cheat a little bit here. My one major player difference, or just on-field difference, is Reek's playing better than he did in that game. He hasn't played like that, like literally since then, giving up the Purcell bomb and then the Tonjes ball. Like, Reek hasn't given up a ball like, as long as those two balls stayed in the air, he has not given up anything like that since then. Like, maybe like he's given up some touchdowns, but like 1 yard stuff, like Puka's no look on Thursday night. And then like Devontae gave up the 1 yard. Like, it's hard to get when the ball's in the air. Reek's going to get it now. But then I think the biggest difference, I may try to write about that this week, is that there's more emotion, I think, attached to this game for Seattle. It's revenge. It's get back. You're gonna hear the term get back quite a bit this week. And that wasn't there. It was week one. They were very hyped. It's just different emotion. Now it's like, once he's on the line, Lenore just continues to just egg on and just poke and prod JSN. You know, who JSN won't say anything about it this week. But, I mean, he's going to want to cook this guy for 100 yards, right? There's just all this emotion attached to it.
JSN.
There we go. I have JSN's numbers when he wears a cowboy hat, too, by the way. I'll give those in a second. But, yeah, there's just all this emotion attached to it. You know, Ernest – It wants some get back. All these guys want some get back. There's one more person I was mentioning. Oh, Eamon Worry wants get back because he got hurt, you know. So the emotion, I think, more than any schematics or any particular position group, is going to be the biggest difference in it. They really want this. It's like the scene in the movie where, like, the team, the sports movie, where they play them earlier in the year and lose, and then now they go through all this stuff, and then they meet them again in the playoffs or something like that, and now there's emotion attached to it. That's this for the Seahawks. I think that's going to matter a lot.
Certainly a lot of emotion. And Julian Love spoke about it, just about playing in this big game for himself. He said, like, I haven't even been in many.
Oh, please. Like, Niners, British Niners fans are very annoying.
They're all annoying. They're all annoying. Every nationality of Niners fans are super annoying.
I agree. So that's
they're the worst. Absolutely. They deserve all the absolute horror that's happened to them for the last 30 years.
All right, Brian, what's coming up on the docket for you?
I will be continuing to egg on 49ers fans because they are the worst. And I will be talking to Grant Cohen tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. I'll be on with Brock and Salk at 8:30. Ahead of that, we will be having the OG Real Hawk Talk crew Thursday. Nathan, Evan, Jeff, and myself on Thursday at 6 o'clock. And I've got a surprise guest Thursday I'm working on. So we'll have a lot of fun with this this week.
Fun surprises. Okay, Mike, what's coming up for you?
Chris and I got our one big thing coming out Wednesday morning after watching the tape. We talked to Grant earlier today. That'll drop Wednesday as well. Love Grant. He's just love Grant. So that'll drop Wednesday. And then we'll do our film review on Friday and fly into the Bay. Seahawks Niners. Can't wait, man. Can't wait.
I like it.
I love big games with high stakes.
That is exactly what this is. And thanks so much for tuning in with us tonight. Hopefully we'll see you all in the new year celebrating an NFC West championship title and the one seed. But from Brian, Mike, Rob, and myself, good night and go Seahawks.